the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
Good evening. Oh, that was better. For those of you who don't know me, my name's Joe. I'm one of the contact workers here. And I've been working as well as a teaching assistant for the last year. And I'm engaged to Kez, who's down there. And we're getting married in September, which is exciting. But I'm going to be speaking tonight. And we're going to be continuing our series on Solomon. And first of all, does anyone know who these two people are?
Very rich.
£161 million rich. For those of you who don't know, Chris and Colin Weir won the Euro Millions last week or the week before, and the jackpot was £161 million. Wow, which is a lot of money. I'd like you to turn to the people around you and think, if you had £161 million, what would you spend it on? And don't worry too much about being nice and charitable. What would you spend it on for you if you had to spend it on yourself? Okay. Did anyone hear anyone say anything particularly interesting? A game reserve in South Africa, or not?
In Africa.
In Africa. Not in England. It wouldn't be much fun in England, would it, really? £161 million is a lot of money, but for Solomon, it probably wasn't that much money, actually. Solomon was rich. He was rich with a capital R. And he wasn't only rich, he didn't just have wealth, but he had a lot of other things as well. Solomon had wisdom, he had wealth, he had power, he had pleasure as well, he had all sorts. And his fame, when he was king, spread around the world. For those of you who don't know, we're going through looking at Solomon's life. Solomon was the son of David, so he lived about 950 BC. He was king of Israel, and his kingdom expanded over quite a large area. And he had influence and power and fame that had spread around quite a bit of the world that they knew about at that time. His fame had spread to the Queen of Sheba. This is one of lots of drawings and pieces of art that have been done about the Queen of Sheba. Music pieces as well have been written about her, and people seem really interested and fascinated by her. And she, I'm sure, was really interesting and fascinating herself, but she was really interested in Solomon as well. In fact, she travelled to come and see Solomon, bringing him lots of things, including lots of spices. This is from the Lego version of the Bible, which is a lot of fun. If you get the chance, look at the website. It's really great. And she came to visit Solomon, and that's the passage that we're going to read tonight. So if you want to turn to 1 Kings chapter 10. Can someone shout out what page number that is? Because I've got a different Bible. 334? 334 in the Green Bibles. And we're going to read about the Queen of Sheba's visit to Solomon, and then the next bit of the chapter, which is about Solomon's splendour and his wealth. So chapter 10. When the Queen of Sheba heard about the fame of Solomon and his relation to the name of the Lord, she came to test him with hard questions. Arriving at Jerusalem with a very great caravan, with camels carrying spices, large quantities of gold and precious stones, she came to Solomon and talked with him about all that she had on her mind. Solomon answered all her questions. Nothing was too hard for the king to explain to her. When the Queen of Sheba saw all the wisdom of Solomon and the palace he had built, the food on his table, the seating of his officials, the attending servants in their robes, his cupbearers, and the burnt offerings he made at the temple of the Lord, she was overwhelmed. She said to the king, "The report I heard in my own country about your achievements and your wisdom is true. But I did not believe these things until I came and saw with my own eyes. Indeed, not even half was told me. In wisdom and wealth, you have far exceeded the report I heard. How happy your men must be. How happy your officials who continually stand before you and hear your wisdom. Praise be to the Lord your God, who has delighted in you and placed you on the throne of Israel. Because of the Lord's eternal love for Israel, he has made you king to maintain justice and righteousness. And she gave the king 120 talents of gold, large quantities of spices and precious stones. Never again were so many spices brought in as those the Queen of Sheba gave to King Solomon. Hiram's ships brought gold from Ophir, and from there they brought great cargoes of almug wood and precious stones. The king used the almug wood to make supports for the temple of the Lord and for the royal palace, and to make harps and lyres for the musicians. So much almug wood has never been imported or seen since that day. King Solomon gave the Queen of Sheba all she desired and asked for, besides what he had given her out of the royal bounty. Then she left and returned with her retinue to her own country. This is where it gets really impressive. Now the weight of gold that Solomon received yearly was 666 talents, not including the revenues from merchants and traders and from all the Arabian kings and the governors of the land. King Solomon made 200 large shields of hammered gold. 600 beakers of gold went into each shield. He also made 300 small shields of hammered gold with 3 minas of gold in each shield. The king put them in the palace of the forest of Lebanon. Then the king made a great throne inlaid with ivory and overlaid with fine gold. The throne had 6 steps and its back had a rounded top. On both sides of the seat were armrests with a lion standing beside each of them. 12 lions stood on each of the 6 steps, one at either end of each step. Nothing like it had ever been made for any other kingdom. All King Solomon's goblets were gold. All the household articles in the palace of the forest of Lebanon were pure gold. Nothing was made of silver, because silver was considered of little value in Solomon's days. The king had a fleet of trading ships at sea, along with the ships of Hiram. Once every 3 years it returned, carrying gold, silver and ivory, and apes and baboons, of course. King Solomon was greater in riches and wisdom than all the other kings of the earth. The whole world sought audience with Solomon to hear the wisdom God had put in his heart. Year after year, everyone who came brought a gift. Articles of silver and gold, robes, weapons and spices and horses and mules. Solomon accumulated chariots and horses. He had 1,400 chariots and 12,000 horses, which he kept in the chariot cities and also with him in Jerusalem. The king made silver as common in Jerusalem as stones, and cedar as plentiful as sycamore fig trees in the foothills. Solomon's horses were imported from Egypt and from Kew. The royal merchants purchased them from Kew. They imported a chariot from Egypt for 600 shekels of silver and a horse for 150. They also exported them to all the kings of the Hittites and of the Aramaeans. Solomon had a lot, and we're going to look at 3 main things tonight. The first of those is what Solomon had. Firstly, Solomon had wisdom. You might have heard Simon speak a couple of weeks ago on how God gave Solomon wisdom, and then Adrian unpacked that last week a bit more, about how Solomon used that wisdom to make some good judgments, and he became known as a really good judge throughout Israel. He wrote most of the Proverbs that we have, we think, in the book of Proverbs. Wrote Song of Solomon and Ecclesiastes as well. And the Queen of Sheba came bringing really hard questions, it says in verse 1. Or maybe more accurately, it was riddles. And Solomon was able to answer all those as well. It says, for all her questions, Solomon was able to give an answer. So the Queen of Sheba was impressed by his wisdom. Secondly, she was also impressed by his wealth. And again, she's amazed. In fact, Solomon had so much wealth that when the writer of this talks about what the Queen of Sheba bought, he focuses more on the spices. So it says, she gave the king 120 talents of gold, large quantities of spices and precious stones. Never again were so many spices brought in. It's like the writer saying she brought in loads of spices. Oh, and actually she brought in about 4 tons of gold, that was, as well, which is unbelievable, unbelievable amounts. In verse 14 of chapter 10, it says, the weight of gold Solomon received was 666 talents yearly. I did some maths, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that was about 20 tons of gold. So 20 tons of gold coming in each year. And that says that wasn't including what he got from merchants, from traders, from all of the Arabian kings and the governors of the land. I imagine all of the Arabian kings had quite a lot of gold as well. So if you add in all that together, Solomon was absolutely loaded. He had loads of gold. And he had power as well. Like we said, his kingdom expanded over much of the region in that area. And some of the wives that he took for himself, unfortunately, were for strategic reasons, so that he can make alliances with foreign kings and with foreign powers. And we read about his trading as well at the end of what we just read. So Solomon was in between the kingdoms of the south and kingdoms of the north, and he controlled the major trade routes in that part of the world. So either people had to pay to go through Israel, or Solomon bought them from the south and then sold them on to the north. So he had shrewd business skills as well. Even Alan Sugar would have been envious of him. And finally, Solomon had pleasure too. It wasn't just that... Oh, hello. There we go. Solomon had pleasure as well. It wasn't just that he had wisdom and wealth and power and those things. He really tried to live life to the full as well. In chapter 4, earlier on, we read about all the food and drink that he had. And it's just ridiculous. I think Adrian might have touched on it last week. But we read in chapter 4 that Solomon had, his daily provisions were 30 cores of fine flour, so that's about 6.6 kilolitres of flour, 60 cores of meal, so about 13,000 litres of meal, 10 head of stall-fed cattle, 20 of pasture-fed cattle, 100 sheep and goats, and that's not to mention deer, gazelles, roebucks, and choice of fowl. Mike, does that sound good? That would be a great game reserve, wouldn't it? Every day, he's getting that much in. It's fantastic. And he was loving it, the living conditions in his house as well. In the section between what Adrian preached on last week and what we're looking at tonight, we hear about how Solomon built the temple of the Lord, but also how he built his own house, which he called the Palace of the Forest of Lebanon. And its name really describes quite accurately what it was like. And we read here about the shields that he put in his house, just hung them up on the walls full of gold, about the throne that he built for himself, which even echoes, if you read later on about God's throne and how that is described, it almost echoes that. And we'll come to that later, about how Solomon started to stray away. But he built an amazing throne, he had gold goblets, even his crockery and his cutlery was amazing. He had servants for himself. And he wrote in Ecclesiastes about all the things that he was pursuing, which I'm just going to read, if I can find it. So Ecclesiastes chapter 2 verse 4 says this: I undertook great projects. I built houses for myself and planted vineyards. I made gardens and parks and planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made reservoirs to water groves of flourishing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had other slaves who were born in my house. I also owned more herds and flocks than anyone in Jerusalem before me. I amassed silver and gold for myself, and the treasure of kings and provinces. I acquired men and women singers, and a harem as well, the delights of the heart of man. I became greater by far than anyone in Jerusalem before me, and in all this my wisdom stayed with me. So Solomon says, whatever I wanted, I just went for it. I went after it. Solomon had wisdom, he had wealth, he had power, he had shrewd business skills, and he had pleasure as well. Not just pleasure in his living conditions, in his house, but companionship as well. It was possibly Solomon who wrote Song of Songs, or it was written about him at least. So he had companionship and sexual pleasure as well he chased after. Solomon had 700 wives and 300 concubines or mistresses. Anything that he wanted, he chased after. He was maybe a mixture. If you put together perhaps Barack Obama, Bill Gates, the Queen and Casanova and kind of roll them all into one, maybe that describes something of what Solomon would have been like. Solomon seemed to have everything. And yet, he says in Ecclesiastes that he wasn't fulfilled. He says it was like chasing after a wind. He couldn't quite grab hold of it, grab hold of what he was really looking for. And actually, although Solomon had all that stuff, he lost a lot as well. Fair enough. We'll forget the PowerPoint, I think. Can we move it on from up there? Is that great? So, what Solomon missed? We get the checkpoints of a king in Deuteronomy, and it tells us in Deuteronomy what a king should be like. It says that a king shouldn't acquire excessive silver and gold. Well, Solomon made silver as common as stone, and he had all that gold coming in mostly to himself, not shared about. So I don't think he got that one. Don't acquire many horses. Verse 26, Solomon accumulated chariots and horses. He had 1,400 chariots and 12,000 horses. Number 3, don't go back to Egypt to get your horses. Solomon's horses were imported from Egypt. Write for yourself a copy of the law and follow it. We don't know if Solomon did that or not. The evidence would suggest that perhaps he didn't. Don't lift yourself up above your brothers. If building yourself a throne and spending longer in your house than God's house isn't lifting yourself up, then I'm not really sure what is. Don't intermarry. We're going to read in a minute. King Solomon loved many foreign women. Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians and Hittites. He failed on that one as well. And don't acquire many wives. Well, 700. It's quite a few. So where did it all go wrong for Solomon? I think he lost focus. It can be a bit confusing, actually. I found it a bit confusing when I was preparing for this, because in some ways, this seems to speak really positively about Solomon, what we've been reading. It says he has loads of wisdom. God met with him twice. He came face to face with him twice. God said he promised to bless him with all these things. In some ways, his kingdom was really prosperous. It was really successful, and he seems to be a really successful king. And yet, even before we get to where he obviously went wrong, there's kind of undercurrents of what's going wrong. We saw how he didn't meet the checkpoints of what a good king should be. And I think his first problem was that he lost focus. And like I said, I'm a teaching assistant, and so I work with a year 5 class this year, and I could probably give you lots of examples of people losing focus. But one was when we went to Wenworthy, which is an activity centre just out past Crediton. And we went there for 3 days with a group of year fours. We had a really great time. Went pond dipping. We went on a night walk. We did all sorts. It was great fun. And the kids had a pack that they had with them. And one of the sheets in that pack was to fill in about a creature that they'd seen whilst we were there. So they had to fill in what the name of the creature was, they had to fill in what it looked like, what its habitat was, what it ate, what its predators were. And one of the girls on the trip was called Abigail. And Abigail speaks very slowly like this. And she was filling in her sheet, which surprised me a bit, because she was doing it just after we'd got there. And we hadn't really had the chance to go out and see any animals. The idea was we went out and find an animal and then filled in the sheet about it. So I said, "Oh, Abigail, you're filling in your sheet already." She said, "Yes." And I said, "Well, what are you writing about? We haven't really seen many animals yet, have we? We've been inside most of the time." "Oh, I'm writing about the Snufflewaffle." "Oh, the Snufflewaffle. Right. Where did you see the Snufflewaffle?" Well, the Snufflewaffle would live in a tree, or it can live in bushes as well. And it's friends with the worms, and she went on and on, all about the Snufflewaffle. She'd filled in this whole sheet, where it was meant to be a fact file about an animal, all about the Snufflewaffle. Maybe there is a Snufflewaffle, I don't know. Look it up when you get home. But she'd lost focus of what she was meant to be doing. Instead of focusing on the main point of that sheet, and one of the key points of going on that trip to find out about nature, her imagination had run wild, and she'd gone off on one about the Snufflewaffle. And Solomon lost focus as well. He was meant to be a godly king. His father David had followed the Lord with all his heart and served him well. Solomon was meant to be doing the same, and yet he just got a bit obsessed with this idea of doing whatever he wanted and getting it now, and he got used to the fact that he had everything and that he could click his finger and anything could be done for him. And he was desperate for more. Like we said, he chased wealth and power and pleasure. And yet he says in Ecclesiastes that he could never get enough. It's like chasing after the wind. You can never quite grab hold of it. You're always left kind of longing for more. So we can see something was starting to go wrong for Solomon. And then we read in chapter 11 where it clearly went wrong for him. And we're going to read that through now. So we'll just read the first 8 verses of chapter 11 quickly. King Solomon, however, loved many foreign women besides Pharaoh's daughter: Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians, and Hittites. They were from nations about which the Lord had told the Israelites, "You must not intermarry with them, because they will surely turn your hearts after their gods." Nevertheless, Solomon held fast to them in love. He clung to them in love. He had 700 wives of royal birth and 300 concubines, and his wives led him astray. As Solomon grew old, his wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not fully devoted to the Lord his God, as the heart of David his father had been. He followed Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and Molech, the detestable god of the Ammonites. So Solomon did evil in the eyes of the Lord. He did not follow the Lord completely as David his father had done. And on a hill east of Jerusalem, Solomon built a high place for Chemos, the detestable god of Moab, and for Molech, the detestable god of the Ammonites. He did the same for all his foreign wives, who burned incense and offered sacrifices to their gods. Or from the Lego Bible. It was Solomon's wives who turned away his heart. Again, it's like chasing after wealth and power. You can never get enough. That applies to relationships as well. Solomon tried and tried to find fulfillment, to find sexual pleasure, to find companionship in women in the opposite sex. But he couldn't get enough. He was never satisfied. And also this shows some of the disastrous consequences of bonding yourself to, well, in Solomon's case, of bonding himself to many foreign women, which God had commanded not. And I think that kind of applies in some ways today. I don't think that's the main point of this passage. But I think it shows us that if we make a really close bond, especially in marriage, to someone who doesn't follow Jesus like we do, then that can have really disastrous consequences. When I was 17, I started going out with a girl who wasn't a Christian, not really seeing anything wrong with it at the time. But actually, I realised after a few weeks that we'd been going out that wasn't really helpful. I think if you're going out with someone, if you're marrying someone, then they're either going to point you towards Jesus or they're going to pull you slightly away from him. And although that might not happen immediately, it can happen gradually. And having done that, admittedly not for a very long time, and you know, we were only 16 or 17, but the difference in that compared to being engaged to Kez now and getting married to Kez now is just huge. So I think, yeah, that's just a slight aside. Like, yeah, it's really helpful to make bonds that are as close as that with someone who shares our passion and our love for Jesus. Solomon made that mistake, and it says he clung fast to his wives instead of to the Lord. He'd been commanded to hold fast, to cling to the Lord, but instead he was holding fast to his wives. Instead of pursuing the giver of gifts, he was pursuing the gifts themselves. And he took something that was intended for good, in this case marriage, and really turned it up on his head. And actually, it's easy to make jokes out of this and make jokes out of how many wives Solomon had, and to put up funny pictures of the Lego Bible showing how many wives he had. But Solomon had 700 wives and 300 concubines or prostitutes, essentially. What a gross, gross violation of God's plan for marriage. You know, in Genesis, God says it's two people coming together, two people becoming one, which is meant to show us something of Jesus and the church coming together. And yet Solomon took for himself 700 wives, some of whom was just for political strategy, probably, and 300 concubines, 300 real people who he just slept with for pleasure. Solomon had started to put himself above God, and that was his problem. And the seriousness of that is seen in the fact that he started to build these high places for foreign gods. It says he built a high place for Chemosh. Chemosh was a god who people often made human sacrifices to. And it says the detestable god of Moab, Molech. And Molech was a god who some people would worship and make child sacrifices to. This is Solomon, who two chapters ago has met with God himself face to face and has seen him and has been given limitless wisdom from God to solve problems, has been commanded by God to follow him. And Solomon, who's encouraged all of Israel to follow God. And now he's building high places for a God, the followers of whom encourage child sacrifices. I think it's tempting to think that Solomon made some mistakes, but often he's portrayed in the light of essentially being quite a good person and quite a wise person. But these sins were really serious. And it's the same for us as well. I think sometimes, I don't know about you, but we can think of ourselves as essentially good people. I think I do that about myself. I know that I mess up sometimes, I know that I sin sometimes, but I think it's kind of all right because essentially I'm quite a good person. But actually our sin is serious, and we have to recognise, like we just did with Solomon's sin, our sins are really serious. We have to admit that. And then, instead of thinking of ourselves as essentially quite a good person, we have to see ourselves as sinful in ourselves. But if we follow Jesus, we have to trust that our righteousness is completely in him. And if we're trusting that our security and our righteousness is completely in Jesus, then that frees us up to do something about the sin that we recognise. We can say at the same time, this stuff I do is horrific, this sin is horrific, but also I am purely righteous and pure in Jesus. And in his power, we can do something about that sin. Unlike Solomon, who we're not told did do anything about what he had done wrong, about his mistakes, who fell away from the God that only eight chapters earlier it says that he loved and he was going to hold fast to. Simon and Adrian over the last couple of weeks have compared Solomon's kingdom to God's new kingdom, which Jesus ushered in. And I just want to do the same to finish tonight. It was hoped that Solomon might be the promised son of David. God had promised David he'd have a son who would sit on the throne and who would bring salvation. And it looked like this might be Solomon. You know, the kingdom seemed to be really prosperous. But actually, if you looked underneath that, there was trouble brewing. Solomon had unfairly taxed people, he'd amassed wealth for himself, he'd begun to centralise the wealth instead of sharing it out as God wished, and he was later condemned by prophets for that. And as a result, people were unhappy. And although this kingdom looked amazing, although Solomon had all that gold that we spoke about, he had all those spices from the Queen of Sheba, he had all that wealth and all that wisdom and this kingdom that was expanding throughout the Middle East, within a generation 11 out of the 12 tribes have been ripped from his descendants. Solomon's son lost 11 of those 12 tribes, and only one was left. And about 250 years after that, the picture shows the fall of Jerusalem, as Jerusalem was invaded and people taken into captivity by the Babylonians. This kingdom that seemed to be amazing, this kingdom maybe some people thought this was what people were looking to when they said a kingdom's going to come through the son of David, had fallen to pieces. But God had a plan. And when Jesus came, when he began preaching in his ministry, he said, "The kingdom of God is at hand. Repent and believe the good news." When Jesus came to earth, it showed us the start of a new kingdom. And that's where what Don read earlier from Matthew comes in. It says that something far greater than Solomon is here. Something far greater than Solomon's kingdom is here. The Queen of Sheba travelled miles to get to visit Solomon's kingdom. She couldn't wait to go and see. She'd heard about his wealth and his wisdom. She travelled from either southern Arabia or from Africa to come and see Solomon's kingdom. And yet that's nothing. That is nothing compared to Jesus' kingdom. Jesus said something far greater than Solomon is here. A kingdom that is not going to fail. A kingdom that isn't going to be fade or can't be invaded or be ripped apart. God's kingdom is here and it's going to last forever. And for us, that kingdom is the only kingdom worth building and being concerned about. The other passage John read said, "Seek first his kingdom and everything else you need will be added to you. If you seek first God's kingdom and his righteousness, everything else will fall into place and be sorted out. I find that a really challenging verse. I found it a really challenging verse recently. I was moving all the stuff out of my house yesterday into our, well, partly into our new house, partly into a friend's house. I've got stuff in boxes kind of spread out around the city, it seems. And I don't like the uncertainty, to be honest. I don't like the uncertainty of planning a wedding as well. I don't like knowing stuff isn't going to be sorted out. And I was really challenged yesterday when I was preparing this. God says, seek first my kingdom and everything else will fall into place. All that stuff you want to know about what you're going to be doing in a year's time, about how you're going to get your house, about how your wedding's going to be sorted, about where your stuff's going to be, about what job you're going to be doing in 6 months' time. God says, I know you need that. I know that stuff's important to you. But trust me, that will be sorted if you seek first my kingdom and my righteousness. And we have the Holy Spirit living in us to help us do that. Unlike Solomon, the Spirit is now available to all Christians, and the Spirit fills us as Christians. And he gives us assurance that that kingdom has been ushered in, and that one day we will see that kingdom in all of its fullness. Let me just read to you the end of Revelation, which talks about the New Jerusalem. See how this compares to Solomon's kingdom. I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away. There was no longer any sea. I saw the holy city, the New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride beautifully dressed for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, now the dwelling of God is with men, and he will live with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things has passed away. Something far greater than Solomon and Solomon's kingdom is here. And we're people of that kingdom. And because our righteousness and our security is sure in Jesus, we can start acting like that. You know, it's like starting a football season and being told that you're guaranteed to win the league at the end of the year. And you might go through the year, and if we lost games, then we'd probably think, if we didn't know we were going to win the league, we'd worry. We'd think, oh, we've lost. You know, we need to get back on a winning track. We need to get back towards trying to get up the league table. But if we were assured that we would win the league, if we'd been taken in a time machine and seen in a year's time that we were going to win the league, if we lost one game, that wouldn't matter. We'd think, oh, we've lost one game, but we know we're going to win the league, so we'll just get up and freely enjoy playing again. And that's a bit like God's kingdom. Our place in heaven, our place in eternity with God is absolutely assured. So if we know we're definitely going to be there, let's start living like it now. Let's not be like Solomon and chase after things of the earth which are never going to satisfy us. Let's deal with God's help with the sin that we see in our lives, and let's start living as the people that he made us to be. And if you're not a Christian, if you're not sure about Jesus and you're here tonight, can I encourage you just to consider that gift that he offers? He offers you a place in eternity with him for free. He died for us on the cross that we could come into relationship with God and have the assurance of that future hope. Let's just pray together. And let's take a few minutes just to think about what we've heard. Maybe that's thinking about Jesus' kingdom, thinking about whether we want to accept that gift. Or maybe that's thinking about our own lives, thinking about whether or not we take the sin we see in our lives seriously. And whether or not we're seeking first God's righteousness. Think about this week. What does it look like for us to seek first God's righteousness and be absolutely assured that our hope is secure in Jesus?